Function Room 45, Empire of the Sum, a history of the pocket calculator with Keith Houston. Another episode title I'm jealous of because I didn't pick it myself. It's the work of Keith Houston, a writer and software engineer who's made a habit of writing about things that are there in plain sight. And we keep meaning to find out a bit more about that. Well, Keith is the man who has done that in a number of areas. He has written about the history of punctuation. He's written a book about the history of the book. And last year, a book about the history of the pocket calculator. There's lots of interesting nuggets in this episode, including how an ant counts, how to count and who counts with their genitals, the unlikely role a tea company played in making calculators, what happens when there's an actual bug in your computer, and when it comes to calculators, what does Keith think is the fairest of them all?
My name is Keith Houston, and I'm the author of Empire of the Sum, The Rise and Reign of the Pocket Calculator.
First of all, as a comedian and also a person who loves puns and good titles, my congratulations to you on your book title. Was it the first one you thought of? Any other puns you wish to share with us that were on the cutting room floor?
I think it was the first one that stuck in my head, and so it has supplanted all others. And happily, we haven't been sued yet by the estate of J.G. Ballard, which is a positive.
Yeah. I mean, if it is, it shows that you have crossed that crucial Rubicon and are now in the heads of the film people as well, too. So, you know, then they start thinking maybe a Netflix series might be along the way. So, you know, it swings and roundabouts.
Fingers
when
crossed.
When I saw the book and heard about it, it was one of those moments where I go, damn, I wish I'd written that, but I wouldn't have been able to. But also, of course, it's about time we talk about this thing that, if you're older than a certain age, was so pervasive, and then you looked away and then it was gone. What was your light bulb moment for deciding to write a book about calculators and pocket calculators?
It was quite a mercenary and iterative process, because I've been casting around for something to write after my second book, which was about the book, the history of the book as a physical object. And I suppose at that point there was quite a lot of sort of 80s nostalgia going around. And my day job is as a software engineer. I studied physics, computational physics at university, and computing felt like too big a thing. There have been lots of really good books written on the history of computing. A lot of them are a bit dry, but at the same time, there's so much interesting information and anecdote out there that felt like too big a subject. But the pocket calculator the more I looked at it, I guess, the more it seemed like a really good lens to basically do the history of maths and computing and calculation without actually claiming to do all of that. And I think in the end, it actually worked out quite well. It was just focused enough, allowed me to talk about really specific moments in time, very specific inventions and people and cultural movements and so on, without needing to take in all of human history.
Yeah. So your book is an app, not a platform kind of thing.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. This is going to sound like a stupid question at the start, but it's always good for me. It makes it easier on the guest if I reveal my own stupidity early on. What is a calculator and what is it not? When we, even in narrowing the focus of what you were going to write about, what defines a calculator?
I thought about this myself as I was writing the book, and I didn't ever explicitly say it because it's a bit like, what was the quotation about pornography? You know it when you see it. you know what a calculator is when you see it. So I think the mental model that I had was, it is a device external to you, its user, that can do some mathematical operations on your behalf in an automated way. And I think I kind of narrowed that down. There's this term of four-function calculator, meaning something that can do addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. And so that, for me, was pretty much the lowest bar. I did initially start out talking about how humanity started counting, and, you know, very, very simple things. I mean, is an abacus a calculator? Arguably not. It does nothing without you. It's a tool to extend your brain, not to take over, you know, some of its responsibilities. But then later, yeah, as I started talking about things that you might think of as being a calculator, you have mechanical calculators, you have relay-driven electrical calculators, and then you move on into sort of electronic ones. So that for me was a calculator, is a device that tended towards this kind of this peak of the electronic calculator in the 70s, but it did some maths on your behalf, I guess.
And in your book, it's a very enjoyable way in which you trace how we get there. I suppose just, we won't go through the entire history because I think people should read your book and find it out. But at what point did a human say, oh, I can't do this in my head? Because at some point you have to abstract and take it out of your head. And why did we decide what sums did we need to do that required anything at all, regardless of whether it was automated or not? Like, because it's not a natural, you know, people didn't start 30,000 years ago going, one day this will be a calculator. They're just in the moment. What is it about humans? Why do we do that? Why do we want to calculate? Again, might be a stupid question, but.
Well, why do we want to calculate? So there have been experiments done that show that basically lots of living things need or want to calculate without even really thinking about it. So there's an African jumping spider that is surprised when it sees more prey creatures than it saw the last time you showed them to it. So it's counting. It's counted how many were there. And it's like, whoa, there are two now. There are fish that can count up to, say, 4 or 5 without too much trouble. And they'll choose between smaller and larger groups of fish. Once you get above that sort of number, they're looking for groups that are much bigger. They can't distinguish between large numbers. You have ants that can find their way in through a maze, and then they go back out of the maze and they tell the other ants in the colony, this is how you make your way through the maze. And so they're effectively saying, take the third left and then the fourth right, and then take the second on the left again. They're counting and they're recounting. They're communicating it to other creatures just like them. So human babies, in fact, again, they have the same surprise thing. If you show them a set of objects and you take one away or add something to the set, and then you show it to them again, they express surprise. Wait, why has it changed? So we can all count. Many animals can count just as a matter of course. It's inherent to being alive in some sense, I think. But for humans, I think humans like tools. That's sort of what makes humans different to many other animals. We devise tools to make our lives easier. So I think the canonical example that's often given in math textbooks is, imagine you're a prehistoric shepherd. You've got a bunch of sheep in a cave. You want to make sure that you get them all back in at the end of the day. So as they leave the cave, you maybe drop a pebble into a bag. And as they come back in, you take a pebble out for each sheep as it comes back into the cave. And you can tell if you have enough pebbles in the bag and exactly the right number of sheep, everything's fine. If you have more pebbles left in the bag, you've lost a sheep. And if you've got more sheep than you had pebbles in the bag, you've gained a sheep. So it's just that was a way of, I guess, not having to hold the results of a calculation in your head. Yeah.
And that preceded the notion of there being 34 sheep or 37 sheep. Like that goes back to, I suppose, which is actually, you know, fairly important part of mathematics, which is it doesn't really matter what the number is, it's more or less than it was. And it's the difference is the important thing, which I suppose is kind of, you know, that's why we had the difference engines and all that. The difference and iteration and increment is the first thing.
It's I guess increments is, we tended to count using very simple things like tokens, right? Pebbles or little clay tokens. In fact, there's I think a suggestion that writing came out of counting. So in Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and Euphrates in the Near East, so basically Iraq, Iran, or what we would now call Iraq and Iran, the people there, I think, are, you know, widely thought to be the first sort of settled farming humans, and they wanted to record transactions. So if I sell you a number of animals, or if we transfer ownership of something, some number of bushels of grain, what are we going to do? Let's use these little clay tokens. So a token of a particular shape represents a certain number of a particular commodity. And in order to make a sort of a singular transaction, they might take some of these tokens and wrap them in a little clay ball, which would harden, so it forms a permanent record of that transaction. Then they realized, hang on a second, we need to break open this ball to find out what was inside it, if there's any dispute. What if we just pushed the tokens into a blob of clay so that you record that, you know, so you make an impression that then hardens and records the transactions? That's where cuneiform writing came from. It came from the marks of these tokens in clay. But I think beyond that, Even before we started, well, yeah, I guess in the vein of tokens, humans often started to learn to count using their fingers. And so that's where you get increment, you know, you get increment from one finger, two fingers, three fingers, and so on. Some cultures used other parts of their bodies. You might have fingers and toes, or fingers and toes and elbows and shoulders and nipples and genitals in some case, in some cases.
like a weird form of the head, shoulders, knees and toes song.
A very long one. I think it was the people in Papua New Guinea who could count up to 33 with their genitals would have had a very long version of that song.
Yeah, I didn't think we'd end up in that area. That's very so we're counting, and then as we proceed through, what are your favorite or notable leaps that we made from the counting? And so I see about the, you know, the abacus was an important thing. Is it very gradual how we developed calculation, or are there leaps made by individuals? What have you found? How we've is it in response to changing situations? So does the method of counting change as quickly as civilization changes, or is there a Pythagoras or an Archimedes figure who makes leaps, do you think?
The problem that you have is that, I guess on the face of it, it looks like the standard sort of hockey stick graph that people imagine represents human progress. You know, stuff happens very slowly over long periods of time, and then suddenly all at once in the let's say the 19th, 20th and 21st centuries, everything just spikes wildly. Maybe that's just a function of us, you know, maybe every age thinks that. Perhaps people in the 19th century thought the same, in the 18th and 17th and so on. But I guess in terms of what we might consider to be different or materially different calculating devices, not a lot changed for a long time. So we were using tokens for quite a long time. And then sometime, let's say between 3000 BCE and maybe 200 CE, so there's a huge span of time, someone invented something which looked and functioned like an abacus. So it started out with tokens. These, you know, I've got a bag of tokens representing a set of things. Okay, let's instead say that a token just means one. I'm going to have a board, a bit like a chessboard, and each column is a digit in a number. So if I put a number of tokens in that column, that might mean I have three units, or I've got three tens or three hundreds, and so on. And that is basically how abacuses work. So that is called a counting board. There's a suggestion that the Mesopotamians, the same people who came up with writing in the first place, may have invented a counting board or something very much like it. It gets a bit more concrete once you get to Rome. So there are a very small number of examples of a little brass plate or little brass plates with slots in them. And each slot represents a digit, and it's got a number of buttons that you can slide up and down on it. And that's called the Roman hand abacus. Now, they're not dated, but I think around about 200 CE is the latest possible date that they could have been invented based on where they were excavated. And then over in China, you've got discussions of a very similar thing, which instead of having buttons running in a slot in this brass plate, you've got beads running on a string or a wire. And the description's incredibly vague. But the abacus, of course, becomes almost synonymous with China. That is the Chinese, that's the device that the Chinese people used to calculate for a really long time, for hundreds or thousands of years. And in fact, it's still quite popular in China and Japan to some extent.
Same with an abacus. What's the most complicated thing you can do on an abacus? Because maybe people listening, and indeed myself, have a vague memory, might have had a toy one. I don't even know if I actually performed any operations on it. I see from your book how to do adding. But they're quite complicated, aren't they? Like, notwithstanding the fact they're not automatic, they can do some heavy lifting.
They can. I'm not going to pretend to know all the details, but there's a really good, I think the best example of this was a story about how just after the end of the Second World War, when the US was basically administering Japan as this sort of defeated enemy in the Pacific, there was a competition arranged between a soldier in the US Army and an employee of the Japanese Post Office. And the US soldier had an electromechanical calculator. So by this point, in the West, we'd been using mechanical calculators for a good couple of hundred years. So this is something, looks a bit like a typewriter, lots of buttons on the front, and it has gears and cams and shafts and rods and belts inside that record inputs and add them to a running total. Maybe you press some maybe you set some sliders and turn a handle, or perhaps you press a button and it increments a running count. So they could do usually multiplication, addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. That's your, you know, classic four function calculator. So Private Tom Woods of the US Army had an electromechanical calculator. And was it Matsuzaki? Oh, this is terrible. I'm going to forget his name. Kiyoshi Matsuzaki of the Japanese Postal Service had an abacus. And they had a competition where they had to carry out a set of each of those four operations. And Matsuzaki won every single one, apart from, I think it was multiplication. And the reason that he was able to, and it was pretty close, but the reason that he was able to win, especially division, was that he had a set of rules just absolutely burned into his memory that he'd learned by rote that says, if you want to divide something in the abacus, here are the shortcuts you can take, here are the mnemonics you can use, here are the algorithms you can use to turn what is actually quite a complicated operation into a relatively simple one. And he was faster even than this guy whose calculating machine returned answers almost instantaneously. So it can, you can do serious maths with an abacus, but I think it still demands more of its user than a calculator does.
Yeah. We'll come to the mechanics in a second, but as you looked at the old ways of calculating things and, you know, the abacus, did you change your opinion of arithmetic? Is it because I found reading the book that the calculator and indeed computers, you've taken for granted that everything sits on a layer of arithmetic and all that. Mm-hmm. But when you boil it down, you start looking at these operations differently, don't you?
You do. I think one of the interesting things for me was, so again, you have the abacus, and it abstracts away some of the, you learn a set of rules which makes addition easier and quicker. You learn another set of rules and it makes multiplication and division a bit easier. I think the big leap and a really clever thing that happened was in the, I think it was the 17th century, there was a Scottish laird called John Napier, lived in Merkeston, which is now part of Edinburgh. In fact, Napier University there is named after him because it's based in Merkeston. He was an alchemist, but then so were all vaguely serious scientists at the time, because that was just what they did. But he wanted to do things like, calculations about astronomical observations, lots of trigonometry. And it turns out a lot of these depend on multiplication, and multiplication was hard. There's not really a good way to make multiplication easier. Yeah.
And just to interrupt, back then, would people have been having discussions about how to solve the multiplication conundrum in the same way that we have, like, how to solve the quantum computing conundrum, or how to do cryptography? Like, was it a thing that people realized, in order to move forward, we need to make certain calculations faster? Were they aware of their limitations?
I think implicitly yes. I can't say to you that yes, people discussed this one particular thing as being something that was holding them back, but the fact that Napier felt compelled to solve it and spent much of his life, you know, decades working on this problem, suggests that he understood quite, you know, intuitively that this needed to be fixed. What he did was he devised a way of doing particular trigonometric multiplications using what are called logarithms. It's a mathematical function. You put a number in the front and you get another number out of the back. And in combination with a really simple algorithm that says, if I want to multiply two numbers, first I find their logarithms, then I add their logarithms, and then I go back the other direction through the logarithm function and I find the multiplied number. And you can set this out in a book of tables. You have what number goes in, what number comes out, and you have to do a bit of addition or subtraction to make it work. You can do multiplication or division. But his book of logarithms was revolutionary. This was spoken of across Europe. It was refined a bit by another mathematician who was around about the same time called Henry Briggs, and he changed it to base 10 logarithms. So I want to multiply a decimal number, two decimal numbers, what's the answer? And that's when it suddenly became really, really useful. But Napier laid the foundations for it. Yeah. And this really changed, I think, how we approach things. And in fact, what happened then was yet another mathematician, a guy called William Oughtred, figured out how to embed logarithms into something that looks like a ruler. This was the slide rule. Yeah. Basically, two bits of wood that slide with respect to one another. They've both got a logarithmic scale on them. And you can multiply any two numbers together in a slightly approximate way really, really quickly. And this then set the tone for how we did maths and engineering and science for hundreds of years, because suddenly addition was relatively easy. You can do it in your head or on a piece of paper. So subtraction, multiplication and division are now easy because you've got your slide rule. And this meant that lots of maths were kind of funneled into a linear form. You would take an equation, you'd figure out the equation that governed the problem you're trying to solve, and you'd say, how can we simplify this within a certain range of values? It roughly approximates to a linear equation, so we're just going to do that. And the problem is, the further towards the edges of that range, that defined range, you go, the less accurate your description of the problem or the phenomenon is. So we ended up with cars that were less efficient than they needed to be. You know, walls were thicker, buildings were squatter and heavier, planes couldn't fly as fast or as far, all because we were sort of we stuck with linearity because slide rules made it easier to do made it easy to do lots of multiplications.
That's interesting, isn't it? That the tool can limit if you become too dependent on it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So and then just for anybody, again, I remember slide rules from my brother had them in when he was studying engineering, but again, they kind of disappeared. So I was glad to meet them again in your book. They're hard to describe without looking at them visually, but they're very deceptively simple looking. I used them as a ruler when I was a child. I didn't know what was going on.
You must have had some really funny lengths then as you get to the end of the logarithmic scale.
Yeah. Coming up in part two, calculators that run like clockwork. Could we talk a little bit about, just before we get into the kind of electronics of the electronic calculators, you mentioned earlier, after the Second World War, the man who had the electromagnetic one and pushing levers and buttons to add. So for a while, everything was clock. People were using effectively clockwork to do sums.
Yep.
Roughly speaking, what's going on? Is it all about gears and like a watch? Like, does something turn, like tick one increment and starts to look a bit like the computer, the thing in the Imitation Game? Is it about is memory the thing? Like, you're trying to store the interim bits of the calculation somewhere, and it's all done with positions.
That's exactly it. Yeah. So if you think about a single number, let's say between 0 and 9, then you can imagine it being on a dial, which is numbered from 0 to 9. You can imagine there being a cog behind it with 10 teeth. And the way that most mechanical calculators worked was they had a kind of running total or a memory, as you say, with one dial or cog for each position, for each digit that you want to manipulate. And they would have a way of turning that digit by the number you wanted to add, or turning it the other way by the number you wanted to subtract. And the key thing then is you need to have a carry mechanism that will mean that any dial that goes back past 0 needs to carry a 1 to the next dial, or back to the, needs to carry down to the previous dial. And that was how they lived or died.
And that carry the one is literally to carry the ones. It's in the same space as when we're, as children, learning how to add.
Yep.
6 plus 5, the 6 plus 5, that's 11, put down the 1, carry the 1. Mm-hmm. That's being replicated in this clockwork thing where the 1 is being physically ticked over on another dial or another area of the machine.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the reason, so there were a few sort of notable mechanical calculators. Blaise Pascal, so the French philosopher, polymath, the guy that said, you might as well believe in God, because if you don't, you're no worse off. And if you do, then you're much better off.
The kind of game theory. Yeah.
Yep. Among many other things, he also did a lot of work to do with atmospheric pressure. But his dad was a tax collector, and he wanted to help his dad do his job. He wanted to make it easier to do lots of routine bits of maths. So for a tax collector, that's mostly basic arithmetic. So he devised a machine called the Pascaline, which was a sort of about the size of a shoebox, let's say, with a dial for each digit, and you would turn each dial with a stylus, or rather, you would turn each sort of input dial with a stylus that would update the number in the output dial, and it would then carry across the next one. But his carry mechanism wasn't great. So he could only handle up to about 6 digits before the machine just started to fail. And so the first really successful mechanical calculator was also the one with a really clever carry mechanism. It was called the arithmometer, and it was developed through the early to middle part of the 19th century. Again, its inventor, a guy called Charles Xavier Thomas de Colmar, spent most of his life trying to perfect this thing, and it did ultimately become somewhat commercially successful. Like his company sold, I think, a few thousand of these things in a world where no one had ever sold more than like 5 or 10 of anything similar. And the way that his thing worked was it had a crank handle that took all of your inputs. So you would set, if I want to add a 5, I'm going to set a slider to 5. I'm going to turn a handle. Each of his dials was updated slightly further along the crank handle. So carries had time to move from one digit to the next. It wasn't one carry which had to then ripple up through the whole of the, through all of the other dials, putting immense strain on the very first one. Each carry happened one at a time. It sort of cascaded. And so it meant that the mechanism of his device was robust and reliable in a way that hadn't really been true of things that had come before it.
Okay. So I can kind of picture that now. So previously, maybe when you turned that first handle, you were also trying to turn 3 other wheels along with their own bits of rust and grease and wear and tear. And that's why it would the calculation, you'd go to add something and you'd break the machine. It feels very tangible. So when it came to the electronic area, and I know there's huge things to cover in this, and we don't have all that time. And also, again, people read the book, it'll be in more detail. But mapping from, like, I can picture wheels and all that, to when we get to electronics, is there an analogy between them, or is it a complete revolution, if you know what I mean, when it comes to then, say, the mid-20th century or the 60s, what's going on there when you press a button?
I don't think it's possible to say that it's a complete clean break, but it's also not. There's also not necessarily a kind of direct connection. What happens fairly quickly is that, well, it all goes back to one particular PhD thesis, which was written in, I think, the mid or late 1930s by a guy called Claude Shannon. And what he did was he said that I have figured out a way to represent any Boolean logic operation using relays. So Boolean logic is just, true or false. And if I've got two true values and I want to AND them together or them or exclusive OR them, it's just a way of describing, logical operations, really. So that's where Boolean logic came from. A relay was a device that was used often in telegraphy. So a relay is an electromagnet. And when you energize the electromagnet, it closes a switch and that lets current flow through a different circuit. So this was used to boost the range of telegraphic circuits. And he figured out a way to build Boolean logic circuits that could, circuits that could solve Boolean logic problems using relays. And this is binary logic. This is, and as soon as you realize that I can do an operation with a true and a false, you realize that you can construct a number from a number of trues and falses. You know, when you think about bits and bytes, an 8-bit number is just 8 trues or falses interpreted as a number, for example, between 0 and 255.
And people listening may have some vague memory in school of they might have had little logic sets where a light would come on or go off depending on whether gates, what the inputs were and what way they kind of configured their little wires. This might have been in physics class in school decades ago for you.
I remember using truth tables. So, if I have two inputs to a particular circuit and one is true or false, and then you basically have a two-dimensional table that tells you what the value is that comes out of, as you call them, gates. That's exactly what you call them in electronics. So Claude Shannon's thesis said this is how you can solve Boolean problems using Boolean logic with relays. And then that lets people build computers out of relays. It lets them build effectively, I guess digital is the right way to think about it. I'm now using individual bits and bytes to represent numbers, to represent letters even. And the improvements from there, so that's quite a step change from what the mechanical machines were doing. You're going from I'm talking about decimal numbers to I'm talking about binary.
Yeah.
And then the second thing that happens is we get better and better at making switches. So relays are fine, but they're quite big and they're quite heavy and they sometimes break. In fact, the first ever computer bug was found by quite a famous computer scientist called Grace Hopper. She worked for the US Navy, and she found a moth that had got stuck between, the jaws of an electromechanical relay. She'd stuck it in a notebook and said I found the first computer bug, because they talked about bugs as being things that happen, you know, problems that happen to computers, and she gave that she found the first actual physical bug that I got stuck in a computer.
So the word bug in that case preceded the literal bug that was stuck in the machine.
Yes. Yeah. So we started with relays, and then we started moving over towards vacuum tubes. So this is, you know, it's effectively a light bulb with some extra wires going into it. And it turns out a light bulb or a vacuum tube is a really good switch. You can switch it on and off really, really quickly compared to a relay. And then someone invents a transistor, and then transistors are embedded on electronic chips, on, you know, like tiny circuits are emplaced in their entirety onto integrated circuits, integrated chips. And that is basically the story of computing since the Second World War. We just get better and better, and at calculation. We get better and better at making switches. And so the things we build are faster and smaller all the time.
And fundamentally, all boils down to the presence or absence of an electrical current, whether it's being switched on or off, and the conclusion you draw based on whether that current is there or not is allows you to kind of represent an answer.
Yes, exactly. Only you're talking about... you're talking about many, many answers being computed simultaneously, and some answers influence others. And at the end of it, the machine you're using, the calculator, knows how to turn that list of yes, no answers into a number that means something to you.
Yeah. And then so something like the pocket calculator, and I realize I'm kind of jumping around now, was that a happy accident as a result of something else they were trying to do within the defense industry, or were people looking for a way of disseminating calculations over to a large number of people so that, you know, 35 people at the lab could be doing calculations together? Or how did it, what was driving it all?
It was quite a mercenary thing. So what happened was broadly, after the Second World War, I think it was the late 50s, the first calculator built entirely of relays was made in Japan by a group of brothers called the Casios, and they would later go on to found the Casio company. And this was a huge thing. It was like a desk, just with relays just packed throughout the whole thing. And this got the attention of the world. No one at that point had built a kind of proper binary calculator. Then a British company was next called Sumlock. They made most of their money through selling taxi meters and betting boards. Okay. But they also sold a very simple mechanical calculator called a comptometer. And they thought that their lunch was going to be eaten by a tea shop called Lyons. And Lyons had built a computer just to run their payroll. There were so many of these Lyons tea shops around the country in Britain that they thought, we can do the work of many accountants with a single big electronic machine. So,
check, are they the Lyons Tea of Lyons Tea fame?
Yes, they're the Lyons Tea of Lyons Tea fame. They built the Lyons Electronic Office, one of the first sort of commercial computers in Britain, probably the world, in fact. So you had this sort of momentum that, you know, Japan built this landmark calculator. Britain came along and built something which was that bit closer to a computer because it used vacuum tubes as opposed to relays. And then America started to sort of get on board a little bit more. And particularly companies, the integrated chip was invented in the States. And that's really, and again, this was just yet more switches in a smaller space. So what happened was the integrated chip was invented by a guy who worked for Texas Instruments. And they went on to make lots of microchips for the US military. They went into things like nuclear missiles. But demand was kind of tailing off. And they needed something else to sell microchips, or rather they wanted something else to sell microchips. And what had happened was the chairman of TI had pulled this trick once already. This was when TI had started making transistors at scale. And they said, let's design a transistor radio and sell this to people. So they miniaturized a traditional radio, something that could fit in your pocket. They had someone else make it, and they sold transistors to the company that made the radio. And this was a big success. And they wanted to do the same thing with microchips. They didn't really know what to make with it. And apparently on a flight, Jack Kilby, the guy who had invented the integrated chip, and the chairman of TI were on this flight somewhere. By the time they'd landed, they'd decided they were going to make an electronic calculator. And they were going to make a pocketable electronic calculator, because they already existed. There were companies who were wiring together big collections of like loose transistors and resistors and so on to make calculators. But they thought, we can pack these into such a small space. Our ambition will be to make a pocket calculator, not because of any real desire to revolutionize how we worked or the set of things we might buy, but just because they wanted to sell more microchips.
And was there other pocketable things going on at the time? Was it the radio gave him the idea, you know, here's a thing that used to be big. Let's see if we can make it small.
That's a really good question. I think the radio is the sort of the canonical example. And I'm not sure there was that much else going on, because one of the theories that I came across as I was reading the book was that the calculator became in some ways the first must-have consumer electronics product. What happened was TI designed something which they called the Pocketronic. It was not a pocketable calculator. It was like the size of a big, heavy hardback book. And they subcontracted out to Canon in Japan, who ended up making it. And they took so long to get the design finalized that actually it sort of missed the boat. And another Japanese company very quickly afterwards came out with a genuine pocketable calculator. They were called Buzzycom, and their calculator was called the Handy LE. And it's about the size of like maybe an iPhone, but slightly, you know, a bit thicker, maybe an inch thick or so on, or so. So that was the first genuinely pocketable calculator.
Just to come in back to, it became pocketable. Consumers didn't know they needed this thing, but they've convinced them in order to use up. They've got an assembly line of a load of microchips in Texas Instruments. What are we going to put them into? It's interesting because you always think that it's inevitable that pocket calculators would just happen, but actually, lots of technical innovations are driven by companies who need to sell, you know, things that they're already making.
Yeah.
What was the impact of when they first became genuinely pocketable and they started proliferating? What did people think? Was there a fear of them in the same way that we fear AI now? Did people fear the pocket calculator and its potential brain rotting, as we think every technology is going to do, rot our brains in some way?
Very much so, yes. What happened was pocket calculators got more and more sophisticated. So I'm sure everyone will know of Hewlett-Packard, so the big American technology company. They had been building big programmable scientific calculators for a few years. There was one, I think their first big one was called the HP 9100A, and it's about the size of a large typewriter. And as soon as Bill Hewlett saw it, one of the founders of Hewlett-Packard, he said, "This is great. I want us to make one that's 10 times smaller, 10 times faster, and 10 times cheaper." And his engineers actually did pretty well. They managed the 10 times smaller and 10 times cheaper thing. I don't think they managed the 10 times faster. But they built a calculator called HP 35, which was a pocket scientific calculator. And this was the first one that really got people's attention as almost like not just a tool, but almost a trinket. You know, it's arguable that very few people actually need all of the things that an iPhone, a modern smartphone can do, but they buy them anyway, and they spend a lot of money on them. And the same thing was true of the HP 35. So math students were selling their cars to buy HP 35s at NASA. Engineers started using them. They had to lock them away because otherwise they would be stolen. You know, even at an upstanding place like NASA, you couldn't rely on your HP 35 not to go walkabout. So this, I think, opened society's eyes to some extent as to what was possible with these pocket calculators. It could do sines and cosines and square roots and so on. All of the difficult stuff that previously you would have been fiddling with a slide rule or looking up a number in a book. And this made people start to look a bit more seriously at calculators, especially in the educational world, as to what is this doing? If we let our kids just have these things, are they going to become incapable of doing maths? And there was a bit of a moral panic about it. There were, you know, reports written and submitted to Congress and so on. And in the end, I think the conclusion was, this is probably okay. You need to take account of the tool that you're giving your children or your pupils to do this work. And in fact, TI came up with a calculator where it had different face plates. And the first face plate let you type in, I think it was the numbers 0 and 1 and plus. and it equals. So all you could do was just increment stuff, but then you could replace the face plates and reveal more and more of the functionality of the calculator.
So parental controls on calculators.
Yeah, as a way of taking your students gradually, you know, yeah. introducing them very gradually to what these calculators could do, and not letting them just short circuit the learning you're trying to have them take in.
Yeah.
And again, there were studies done at different universities, and they found that students who weren't quite as good at maths actually benefited from having calculators because it let them. Well, first they were almost like a point of focus, almost a toy that held their attention for a bit longer than it might have otherwise been there. But also, they were able to start exploring almost more complicated concepts. If you don't have to worry about addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, and frankly, who does anymore? It let you think about more difficult stuff. It let you think about how mathematical functions might work. What's really happening here? Not what are the mechanics of it?
Yeah.
So it turned out to be mostly a positive thing. And I mean, I'm sure you would have been the same. I remember using a calculator all the way through high school and even into university, especially scientific calculators. Calculators could do really complicated things, but I was still learning. I still had to appreciate what, you know, matrix multiplication meant. I still had to appreciate what a sine was, what a cosine was. And the calculator, I think, helped me. It didn't hinder me in that.
And yet, they, as a object of desire, have sort of faded away now. What was their death knell, or at least what has delivered a why do I not have one in front of me? If you know what I mean. Well, obviously,
because you have no respect for the past.
Yeah.
I think there were two things. When the home computer came along, and specifically, I think it was the Apple II, it had an electronic spreadsheet program on it called VisiCalc. And spreadsheets were things that accountants had used, only they were made of paper or it was on your blackboard. And you would laboriously add up everything in a column. And if you changed one value, you'd have to figure out all of the other values that depended on it to recalculate it, you know, probably using a calculator, and then update your spreadsheet. So VisiCalc did all this automatically. And I think that took a lot of the drudgery out of sort of large scale but rote mathematics, the kind of things that companies needed to do from day to day, just in order to function. So the pocket calculator was no longer as necessary a tool for that sort of work. And then it just, you know, then you get things like mobile phones. And not all of them, but I think quite quickly, there was a view that, well, we can have a calculator app on this. You know, the keypad of the mobile phone is very similar to the one in the calculator. It's actually inverted, it's the other way up. But it's very similar. And so phones kind of, you know, it became the gadget that you always had on you. And if it's always got a calculator in it, why do I need a calculator? Nowadays, I think some school pupils at least are being given access to programs that can do largely the same set of things that scientific calculators can do. I think they still use, you know, basic calculators when they're younger. But we just use computers, whether the computer is a big one sitting in front of us or whether it's a small one in our pocket. That is what has happened to the calculator. And they haven't gone away. They've become the ghost in the machine. There is still an application that mimics a physical calculator, but it's being driven by this vastly more powerful machine.
Speaking of the vastly more powerful machine, do you ever think of one day we'll be digging out our calculators, hoping the batteries still work because they're not networked, non-hackable? Will the pocket calculator be our Battlestar Galactica of the future? Is there a value in a machine that isn't networked in its own intrinsic self, do you think?
I think the answer is probably for some people there will be. I feel like there's a move towards sort of like the arts and crafts movement when mass production first became a thing that was influencing how people worked and lived. There was a real movement to not lose the value of, you know, good, honest, hard handiworks. And I think perhaps the pocket calculator, the physical pocket calculator, has a role a bit like that. Perhaps you can see people consciously disconnecting, consciously putting their phone away. But I don't know. I like predicting this sort of networked AI apocalypse is sort of a trite thing to do. And I don't know if we really know what will happen, how it will play out. And it feels like something is accelerating. Our desire to care about it is accelerating, whether or not it's getting any closer. So I honestly don't know. I don't think I have a good answer for you.
And finally, do you have a design classic favorite calculator, one that is the marries function, look and feel, and was its high point? Is there something that you are, you know, something about the digits, the buttons?
The HP 35 that I mentioned earlier is a really good example of when companies started to take calculator design seriously. I think the nicest calculators, ironically, are actually mechanical ones. They're adding machines made by Olivetti, which was a gigantic corporation at the time. And they're just aesthetically very, very pleasing calculators. In fact, the Olivetti Divi Summa 18 was an electronic one, and it's just amazing. It's like a prop from Star Trek in 1970, Star Trek movie in 1977 or thereabouts. Really fantastic device to just look at.
So that's the Olivetti. What's the model again?
The Divi Summa 18.
The Olivetti Divi Summa 18.
Divi Summa, so like, you know, division and also sum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Olivetti Divi Summa 18. I'll bring that up at the next time I'm leaning against the wall at a wedding, just to introduce it into small talk. Because you just know there's a huge market for people talking about their fond memories of calculators. And did you play that game where you tried to see how fast you could count? You know, you go 1 + 1 = and then keep on pressing equals to see how many times you could press the button in a minute.
I think it was more, you know, trying to write messages upside down on the screen. maybe not even messages, maybe just one word over and over again, which is, you know, obviously hilarious at the age of like 12.
Particularly to the 12-year-old boy, I think it was very much the transgression, the calculator as an aid to writing something rude. You know, it felt like it was our friend then.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that's a really good way to think about it.
Keith Houston, thank you so much for coming into the Function Room. What are you working on next, by the way?
It will be a book on emoji to be published, I think, next year.
Very good. Might talk to you about that. We'll shoehorn some mathematics into that. There's encoding in there and there's numbers
there
behind
numbers.
All those emoji. So we look forward to that. Keith, thanks so much.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
That's it from the Function Room this week. My thanks once again to Keith Houston, author of Empire of the Sum. And I'm looking forward to his history of the emoji as well. If you liked the Function Room, please share and subscribe on your platform of choice and leave a review. But for now, from me, Colm O'Regan, thank you very much and goodbye until next time.